This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. I'm starting tonight with the first lecture in a series of three on communicating the gospel today and tearing down the walls. This was the subject which the committee here particularly wanted me to speak about, I think. One or two of them had heard me last year at Greensboro addressing this issue. The lectures won't be exactly the same. There'll be a third one, and they're always slightly different. But the issue I want to really address in these three lectures is the difficulty that many Christians find in communicating the gospel today. And I want to begin by reading two passages of Scripture. The first from Matthew 5, a passage you're all familiar with, I'm sure, verses 13 through 17, through 16. Matthew 5, 13 through 16. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. Hear Jesus' challenge that we are to be living in the world, among people, as his salt and his light. And then from John chapter 17, verse 15 through 19. This is part of Jesus' prayer for his disciples on the night before he was crucified. And his prayer not only for his disciples then, but for the whole church throughout its history. So when we read these words in John 17, we are reading what was uppermost on Jesus' mind as he went to the cross, in terms of what he wanted his church to be, what Jesus prayed then for, and what he prays now for you and I. And just a short part from this prayer, John 17, verse 15. My prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of it. Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. For them I sanctify myself, that they too may be truly sanctified. And Jesus goes on in the next verse to say, my prayer is not only for them, but for all who will believe in me through their message. So this is Jesus' prayer for us too. Now, if I were to ask you to put up your hands and say, how many of you find it easy to communicate your faith as Christians to unbelievers? I'm not going to do that because some of you might find it embarrassing. And you might wonder, what will people think about me? But I think if I were to ask you that question, there are very few of you who would be able to, with real honesty, put up your hand and say, yes, I find it really easy. In fact, I find it a great pleasure to communicate what I believe to non-Christians I have many contacts where I'm able to do that regularly. This is just a normal part of my life. I remember asking a class of my students at the seminary where I teach, and I think only one person in the class put their hand up out of 50-odd people. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if we got the same kind of proportion here. I think that one of the most striking characteristics of the evangelical church today is this problem. The difficulty people have expressing their faith, their understanding of Christian truth, to unbelievers. That is the reason, I suggest, why many of our churches are filled with evangelistic programs which attempt to deal with that problem, which are intended to be a means of forcing Christians out into the community to communicate their faith. Now, I don't want to talk now about those programs. What I would suggest is that they are not the fundamental answer to the problem. And I think most Christians who've tried them are aware of that. Most churches who've tried them are aware of that. They don't address the problem we have at a deep enough level. What I want to talk about this evening is the barriers or the walls that we find that exist when we come to think about communicating the Christian message to people today. I want to start by saying a little bit about some of the barriers which the culture erects. Some of the problems we find when we actually do get to communicate to non-believers. I want to say a little bit about that, but I want to spend most of the time this evening concentrating on the barriers that exist in the church, which make communication to people in our society very difficult. Because it's my very deeply held conviction that the barriers that we have raised as Christians in our churches are the real reason why we find communication with unbelievers difficult. The barriers the culture erects are nowhere near so difficult to overcome as the barriers we have erected ourselves. Now, that may surprise some of you when I say that. But let me start by just saying a very little bit about some of the problems we face in seeking to communicate the gospel from people in our society. Some of the barriers in the general culture. And I want to suggest four that we constantly run up against. The first I'm going to call cynicism. Cynicism. Many of the people in our society are basically cynical about the possibility of ever finding truth, of ever finding any real answers, of ever finding any ultimate significance or meaning to their lives or purpose. That's one of the characteristics of the society in which we live. A very deep skepticism, a very deep sense of uncertainty about human existence, about why we're here. Just before I came, or just before I left St. Louis a week ago, we had a conference in Florida, in Orlando, before we came up here, a conference in Orlando last weekend. I had a game of tennis with some friends in St. Louis. And one of the people who played that evening I hadn't met before. He was an older man, a man in his 70s, retired, and we had a game of doubles together. And then we got chatting afterwards, and he just told me just straight that he was a cynic, that he regarded himself as a disciple of H.L. Mencken, the great American journalist. His name will mean something to some of you. I think he was editor for many years of the Baltimore Sun or some such paper. But a celebrated cynic, a man deeply cynical about ultimate meaning, cynical about the Bible, cynical about Christianity, cynical about ever finding truth. And this man said to me very cheerfully, well, it's very easy for you people to believe in God and Christ and the Bible and all that, but I've chosen the really difficult path, the path of cynicism, the path of believing that there are no ultimate answers. And we had a very interesting conversation together. But you will meet many people who, if they're honest, are cynical. That's true at every level of life. If you go into our inner cities, a vast majority of the young people there are deeply cynical for all kinds of reasons. But ultimately, there is no certainty in our culture that there is truth to be found or ultimate meaning to be found. Let me read a little bit from an article from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. It was just 11 days ago. And this reflects very clearly an idea which is simply part of the air that we breathe in this culture. This is a religious philosopher, Loyal D. Rue. Wonderful name. Loyal D. Rue, R-U-E. And he's writing about how modern culture urgently needs a noble lie. What he means is a myth that links the moral teachings of religion with the facts of life. And he said this at a recent symposium of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He said that science and all kinds of other fields have eroded the plausibility, the believability of Judeo-Christianity. The impossibility of believing in God, the God of the Bible, of believing in the Bible, of believing in the message that the Bible communicates, the facts of Jesus' life and so on. He said, this impossibility has got into our heads and consciousness in such a way that the traditional myths, that is the beliefs of Christianity, he's saying, can no longer be swallowed. He said, there are archaic views of the universe, a presumption that humans are the center of existence, the stories of Jesus' resurrection and Moses bringing down God's Ten Commandments from the mountain. Now, he believes that all of these things are myths, myths which are totally implausible, which nobody in their right mind today can possibly believe. Now, many of the people around us are affected by that view. I would say the majority of the people in this society, I don't care what the opinion polls say, about 90% of the American people still believing in God, you actually get down to really talking to people and you will find that ultimately people are cynical. They have no certainty of any final meaning in their individual lives. And this man goes on to say, dispel the myths of religion, all that is left is nihilism. Or nihilism, however you prefer to pronounce it, which considers life and the universe meaningless. So that is the ultimate reality that our society faces. Nihilism. Life and the universe are ultimately meaningless. And he says, this cannot be argued away. I assume it's true. But it is ultimately destructive, he acknowledges. He says this is a monstrous truth. That's where he suggests our culture is, holding this monstrous truth that there is no meaning in the end. Now, I want to come back to this in my third lecture and talk about how we may communicate to the cynic. But that's my first point in terms of barriers erected by the world. What makes it difficult to communicate to people is people really don't expect you to have anything true or sensible to say as a Christian. They simply doubt that it's possible. Secondly, relativism. Relativism. The second barrier that we face when we seek to communicate to unbelievers around us is relativism. Relativism in the sense that people think that you can believe anything you want to, that belief is purely personal, or that moral values are purely personal, that it's really up to the individual to decide what I'm going to believe and how I'm going to live. Again, it's related to the first, that there is no ultimate truth. So truth and the way I live is really up to me. Now again, this is absolutely basic to our culture. We cannot understand our culture unless we recognize that this is the situation. If you doubt that this is the situation, let me recommend to you the book edited by Robert Bellah, B-E-L-L-A-H, Habits of the Heart. Robert Bellah, Habits of the Heart. That is an examination of ordinary American men and women and what they believe and how they live. And his conclusion over and over again in that book is that in the end, people in this society, the vast majority of them, believe that faith, what you believe, is purely personal, and that the way you live is purely a matter of choice. Let's take, for example, the whole abortion issue. The reason Christians don't communicate on that is because the people around us are convinced that it is simply a matter of choice. It's no surprise that the pro-abortion movement is called the pro-choice movement. That's where our culture is, that it is simply a matter of individual choice, that nobody else can tell me how I ought to live. Let me remind you, as we think about this, of a couple of court cases that took place in the last few months, which underlined this very clearly. The one was the case in, was it Cincinnati, or was it Cleveland? Anyway, somewhere in Ohio, where there was the case about Robert Mablethorpe's pictures and whether they were obscene. Now, many Christians were extremely surprised by the outcome of that case. If you read anything about those photographs in the press, you will know that there was absolutely no question that they were obscene on any kind of objective standard at all. Some of them were most certainly obscene. But you will remember that the jury of ordinary American men and women were not able to declare that those pictures were obscene. If you read the articles in the press afterwards, you will find that many of the jurors said this: I personally thought they were obscene. I didn't like them. But I can't say that they're obscene for somebody else. That maybe these pictures had some kind of wholeness, fit with Robert Mablethorpe's particular lifestyle, homosexual lifestyle. That for him and for other people who like them, these are not obscene. So they personally thought they were obscene, but they were not able to say they are objectively obscene. Now, exactly the same thing happened down somewhere on the south in Louisiana or Florida, wherever it was, with the case of Two Live Crew's lyrics. which again are without any question obscene, appallingly obscene, tremendously offensive, the way some of them speak about abusing women. Appalling. But again, the jury was not able to declare that those lyrics were objectively obscene. And again, if you read the articles in the press, you will have heard the jurors saying, I personally don't like it. I wouldn't want to listen to those lyrics. I don't like that group. But they were not able to find themselves able to say, these are in fact objectively obscene. You see, moral relativism, relativism about both truth and moral values, is very deeply ingrained in our culture. I even find many Christians affected by it. And we'll come back to that point later. Now, as you think about those two points, cynicism or skepticism and relativism, what is striking is that the philosopher Nietzsche over 100 years ago prophesied that that's the way our culture would be. He said this, that as the belief that God does not exist becomes widespread in our society, its effect will be what he called the gradual spread and growth of annoying and crumbling skepticism and relativism. The spread of annoying and crumbling skepticism and relativism. That was Nietzsche over 100 years ago, and that's exactly where we live today. Now, those two barriers make communication difficult. It's not easy just to go to somebody and say, this is what I believe. Because they just respond, well, fine, that's fine for you, that's great. And this is how I should live, this is how I think we should live. And they say, well, that's fine for you, but I don't think that. And you haven't communicated anything except what your personal faith and morals are. You've not communicated anything to people. If that's all you do, go and say, I believe this. So that creates a barrier. Cynicism, the expectation that there is no truth, relativism, truth and moral values are purely personal. The third barrier we face is that people believe that life has to find its meaning entirely in the present. People in our society have no sense of eternity. They may tell you in opinion polls, 90% of them, that they believe there's a heaven and a hell. Lots of them think they're going to heaven, and very few of them even think they're going to hell. But if you actually look at people's lives, what you find is that they are living as if here and now was all that there is. When it actually comes down to the way people live, the way they make their choices, the priorities they develop in their lives, every decision they make is based on being convinced that I have to give my life meaning here in the present, right now. That's where pleasure, that's where satisfaction, that's where fulfillment has got to come, here in the present. And of course, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, the passage that Dick was referring to earlier, if Jesus isn't raised from the dead, well, then that's absolutely right. Let's eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. If that is indeed the truth, that there is simply here and now, well, let's just get on with it. We might say that's what secularism really is. Secularism comes from the Latin word saeculum, an age. That is, life is simply this age. It is here and now. It's entirely up to me to get what I can out of life, to make the choices which will give my life fulfillment. So that's the third problem we face. People's lives, we might say, are governed by pleasure and pain. Dorothy Sayers put it that way. She's talking about if you lose a belief in God, Then she said, pleasure and pain will be kings in your cities. Well, they sure are. Pleasure and pain are kings in both our cities and suburbs. In the most striking way. And again, that makes communication rather difficult because everyone around us is seeking total satisfaction in the present. And they're not concerned to hear about their eternal destiny. What about the fourth barrier raised by our society? And all of these are very closely, integrally related to each other. The fourth is the idols that people actually worship. People may say they believe in God, but actually, you find out what they really believe in by looking at their lives. And our society is filled with idolatry. People's idols are work, money, materialism of one kind or another, pleasure, sex, oneself, whatever. That's what people build their lives around, many of them, those things. They worship and serve some aspect of the creation rather than the Creator when you actually look at people's lives. And again, that makes communication quite difficult because people feel very satisfied, at least at first, with the idols they worship. And we will come back to that point again in our last lecture to look at all four of these barriers and how we might go around dismantling them. But that brings me to the main point I wish to speak about this evening, and that is the barriers that we erect as Christians. Now, some of you may find that some of the things I'm going to say in this section are offensive. You may think, well, he is just somebody coming here from the outside, from England, and he's just being critical of the church. I hope you don't take offense. The things I'm going to speak about, I speak out of love for the church and of love for this country. This is my home now. I live here in St. Louis, and I have no plans to go back to England or anywhere else. This is where the Lord has called me. So what I'm saying comes out of a deep commitment to the Church of Jesus Christ in this society. So I say that to hope that you won't be offended, because I'm not coming at this with a critical spirit, just with a desire to understand some of the difficulties that we face. Perhaps to step back a little bit, when one first comes as a European to this country to live here, the health of the church is very striking in comparison with the churches in Europe. Here, vast numbers of people go to church. If you come from England, like I do, a very tiny proportion of the population goes to church. And in many parts of the country, it's 4 or 5 generations since people have gone to the church at all. Church isn't even a memory for the vast majority of the British population. There's a total ignorance of the Bible and its content in the overwhelming majority of the British population. As I said, it's 4 or 5 generations very often since people have gone to church. Now, it's very different here. Very different. Where I live in St. Louis, there are huge new churches which have sprung up all over the place. What you find in England is churches closed down all over the place. Here there are new churches all over the place. A vast group of people claim to be evangelical Christians in this society. The figures are very striking. Something like 40% or maybe even more claim to have a born-again experience, claim to believe in Jesus Christ. many, many people go to church. If one decides to plant a church, the denomination in which I am involved and whose seminary I teach, the PCA, the Presbyterian Church in America, is doing a great deal of church planting. And if people come out from our seminary to plant a church, in many cases, those churches will really grow. And maybe even the very first Sunday you meet, you can have 100 people there or even more. And after 2 or 3 years, maybe 200 or 300. And after 10 years or 12 years, the church we were at in Florida, I think, has been in existence for 13 years. It started meeting in somebody's home, and now it has 1,200 people. And there have been other churches which have grown out of it in the area, too. Now, that is an image of a striking health of the church for a European. If the same people who planted that church in Orlando, or any other church which one plants here and which grows rapidly like that, if those same people were to go to France or Italy and try to plant a church, maybe at the end of 15 years, if God had really blessed them, they might have 15 or 20 people, or possibly even 30, if the work had gone really well. That tells you a little bit about the dramatic difference there is between working in parts of Europe and working here in the United States. The church has a much greater vigor and vitality here. However, if we look more closely at the church, I want to suggest that there are some very serious problems. Some problems which are exemplified in this difficulty people find in communicating with unbelievers. Because my conviction is that we have erected walls between ourselves and the unbeliever, which make communication difficult. And I want to think about this under two problems, under two headings. If you remember, we read in Matthew 5 and John 17 that we are to be in the world, but not of the world. I want to suggest the first problem that we face is that we have retreated from the world, that we are not in the world, that evangelical Christians today, by and large, seek to separate ourselves from society, to separate ourselves from the general culture. We might say that we seek to keep the salt in the shaker and to keep the light under the bushel. Coming back from England to live here after having lived here 20 years ago, after looking at the health of the church, and then secondly seeing some of the really serious problems with the church, expressed, for example, by the televangelist scandal, but that is just the tip of an iceberg in terms of the problems, I began to think, now, what are the real problems? And the third thing I noticed was the separation, retreat from the general culture. There has been a proliferation of everything Christian in the last 20 years. Now, some of this is good, so don't take what I'm going to say now as critical of everything. But then there's a vast growth of the Christian school movement, for example. There's been a vast growth of Christian television and Christian radio, of Christian rock music, of Christian absolutely everything, even Christian trivia games. You can have everything explicitly Christian if you want to. And this is by many considered to be a good thing. Now, what's really going on here? Why has there been this development of what I choose to call the corner culture? What Dick called a fortress mentality. But the development of a corner culture. Because it's not just a fortress that we seek to hide in, it's we have sought to develop our own culture to surround ourselves with, to keep ourselves apart from the world. It's one of the most striking characteristics of evangelicalism in this society. What is the motivation for this? The motivation for this retreat from the culture, for this development of the corner culture, is fear, fundamentally. A fear of what is happening in our society. Now, that fear is perfectly understandable. A fear of the ideas that are taught in the culture. Parents and churches are afraid of the ideas taught in the public schools and in the universities of this society. So they seek to separate themselves and their children from them by developing Christian schools and Christian colleges and Christian magazines and Christian everything else. A fear of what we readily see as a moral breakdown in our society. As believers, we are appalled by many of the things happening in our culture, whether it's in the area of human life or in the area of human sexuality or anything else we might think about. We are really shocked. We are overwhelmed. Cases like the Robert Mapplethorpe case and the True Live Crew case. That's a real mouthful. I'm sure that's why they chose it. The True Live Crew case really shock us as believers. We think, what is going on in the world that nobody can even say, this is obscene, these terrible things? And we are really appalled. And our response to that fear is to retreat, to withdraw ourselves from the culture so that we won't be contaminated by it and so that our children won't be contaminated by it. I heard a leader of one of our churches saying the following words, and they were so striking to me. He stood up in church one Sunday morning, and I won't say where this church was, but he said, "We want to build ourselves a gymnasium. Because we want to create a haven for ourselves and our children from the world, from the society. We meet here to worship God. We have our school here for our children. We have all our friends here. Many of us have our business contacts here in this church. Now we're even going to be able to have our sports here. We won't have to have any contact with the unbelievers at all. We will be safe from them. We will build ourselves a haven here." Now, he was saying this to sell the idea of building a gymnasium, to get people, to encourage people to give money to it. We want to create a haven for ourselves from the world. Now, that is tremendously appealing to people. Let's isolate ourselves as much as possible from society. I remember talking to a couple who were educating their children at home, and they said that is the purpose for our doing this. We do not want our children to have any contact whatsoever with non-Christians, with non-Christian kids, and with this non-Christian society. We want to keep them safe. Now, let me tell you, Christian education can be a very good thing. But if our primary purpose for having it, either Christian schools or homeschooling, is fear of the culture and withdrawal and isolation, those are not good enough reasons. Christ has commanded us, prayed for us, that we are to live in the world and be the salt of the earth and the light of the world, not to withdraw ourselves from it. If we are going to have home education, homeschooling, and Christian schools, their primary purpose must be to prepare our children to understand the world and live in it, not to be retreated from it. But I see this as a motivating factor for many Christians in much of their lives. I find at the seminary where I teach, and there are several students here from there, so I better be careful what I say. But I find at the seminary where I teach that many students are really reluctant to develop relationships with non-Christians. And not just reluctant, but they have been taught in their churches that one shouldn't do so. But our calling is to separate ourselves from unbelievers so that we won't be contaminated by what they think and what and the way they live. And when I challenge students in my classes, and I have a couple of classes where I require interaction with somebody who isn't a Christian, where I say in one class, you have got to get to know an unbeliever and find out what they believe and why they believe it. And in the other class, you've got to go to a non-Christian and ask, what is your major objection to the Christian faith? Now, I taught that class last year both to our day students, the students who have come from all over the country and are training for the ministry, and also to evening students, mostly from the St. Louis area, including many pastors. And when I gave that assignment, you have to get to know a non-Christian and ask them what their major objection to the Christian faith is, I had many students coming to me saying, please let us do something else. I'm serious. Please, can we do something else? I had people coming to me saying, I don't know any non-Christians. I have never known any non-Christians. Now, I'm being serious. I don't know non-Christians. I have never known non-Christians. Please let me do something else. I would like to write a theoretical paper about humanism or whatever. Now, my response was to harden my heart. I guess the one occasion when I could say hardening my heart was justified. But to harden my heart and say, no, if you want to take this class for credit, this is what you've got to do. But then I even had some of the students, now this was some of the community coming in the evening, saying, okay, well, we'll just take the class for audit and not for credit. So we won't have to do this. Now, I'm being serious. I had people coming to me crying individually after class saying, I simply cannot do this. Now, some of those people were involved in evangelistic programs, but they were not prepared to actually get to know somebody to the point where they could ask them real questions about what they thought. Now, that's very distressing. It's very distressing, and that underlines the seriousness of the problem, of the way we have indeed separated ourselves from the culture, that people should respond in that way and should find that difficult. Well, let me give another illustration which captures this in the very saddest kind of way and which characterizes really, I think, what is the heart of the problem. And that is the heart of this problem of separation from our culture is what I would call the us-them problem. That we think that our calling is to surround ourselves with Christian friends, with believers, and keep ourselves separate from unbelievers. And we are afraid of them. The unbeliever is them. And most evangelism simply consists, I'm afraid, in cutting a tiny little hole in the huge wall that we have made, running out for a few moments into the society and then rushing back in and hoping that we've caught somebody in the process. Now, I don't believe that that's what evangelism is biblically. I don't believe that that's what Jesus was doing. I do not believe that that's what Paul was doing. When I read the Gospels, I see Jesus associating with the most unwanted, unrespectable people of his day, with the prostitutes and the tax collectors and the lepers. He didn't seek to separate himself from them to keep himself clean. That's what he criticized the Pharisees for, that they tried to keep themselves clean by keeping themselves separate. But let me tell you a story, and this was something that happened to one of my own sons a few months ago. He had invited a friend from school to come home for the weekend with him, to stay for the weekend. And he and this friend were having a conversation. And my youngest son, Philip, was talking about the fact that he's a Christian, that he's a believer. And his friend said, "Well, I think that's all nonsense. You know, I'm an atheist, and I believe all that stuff about God and the Bible is just rubbish." But then he said this. He said, "However, Philip, don't tell your dad that I'm an atheist, that I'm not a believer." And now listen to this very carefully, because it is so sad. He said, "Don't tell your dad, because I know he's a pastor and he will hate me." That's what he said. The 14-year-old boy said, "Don't tell your dad, because he will hate me because I'm an atheist. And he won't let me come to stay with you for the weekend." Now, sadly, that is the truth in many Christian homes. That we would be afraid of a boy like that. And we wouldn't want him in our home. Now, Philip assured him that I wouldn't hate him, that he would be welcome to come and stay, and we've got quite close to him, in fact, because he's come quite a few times. But that little story, I think, encapsulates the real problem, that is how unbelievers see us, that we desire to keep ourselves separate from them, to keep ourselves pure. They see us as self-righteous, separating ourselves from the world. Now, as we think about this us-them problem, this problem of separation from the culture, where we find that rather than involvement in the culture, we retreat from it. Rather than caring for people and getting to know them, we separate ourselves from them. Rather than communicating with people, we condemn them. I think it's time we stopped condemning unbelievers and start recognizing that they have a right to judge us. I mean, that's what Jesus says in Matthew 5. That the unbeliever looks at our lives and glorifies our Father who is in heaven if there's something positive to see. And Jesus went on to say in John's Gospel, "By the way you live, by the way you love one another, people will know that you are my disciples." We shouldn't be condemning unbelievers. We should be living before them in such a way that they can have a good look at us and decide whether they think there's something here that matters, that's worthwhile pursuing. But this problem of separation, of us-them, is compounded by what I've called the ancient modern problem. When an unbeliever comes into our churches, he hears a language that he doesn't understand. John Stott uses the image in one of his books of a Grand Canyon. On one side of the Grand Canyon is the ancient world of the Bible, and on the other side of the Grand Canyon is the modern world. And very often what we expect is that the unbeliever will actually learn our language, that he will cross the Grand Canyon from his side and come over to us and learn our language before we can actually communicate the gospel to him. Even many of our evangelistic programs require that somebody understands and speaks our language. When my sister was converted, I come from a completely non-Christian family. She was converted staying with us one weekend. This was quite a few years ago now. And we encouraged her to get involved in a church. And in England, you don't have the luxury of deciding which church you're going to get involved in, usually. There's usually only one live church, if one at all, in any community. And so she got involved in the nearest evangelical church to where she was living at that time. But she came back to me after 3 or 4 weeks and she said, "Jeremy, I don't understand anything they're saying." And now she was a Christian. And she just simply didn't understand it. In England, we call it the language of Zion, that we speak. We have our own language. And I want to come back to this later, to speak about learning the language of our culture if we're actually going to communicate to people. But that compounds the us-them problem, because people hear us speaking about what we believe, and even the words we use are unfamiliar. They're no longer part of the culture in which we live. That brings me to the second problem. The first, that we have created this wall, is the separation from the culture, exemplified in our retreat, in our isolation, in our us-them mentality. The second problem we face is captivity by the culture. Jesus said to his disciples that you are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. He said you've got to live in the world, but not to be of the world. I've suggested that we've tried to get out of the world rather than being in it. But I want to suggest at the same time that we are actually of the world. This is the second problem we face. That we are in captivity to the culture. Now you might say, how can that be? That sounds like a kind of paradox. Well, it is, at first sight. How is it possible for the church to be separated from the world and yet to be thoroughly worldly? Because that's what I'm saying. How is it possible for the church to be separated from the world and yet thoroughly worldly? Actually, I think it's inevitable that that's the consequence of trying to separate yourself from the world. Because we kind of think we're safe. And then if I could use an image, let's imagine this room. It's a good example. We haven't got any windows. Let's imagine we were now to bolt all the doors. And say, here we are safe, a group of Christians together. The world is outside. The world is at bay. We have made our haven here to keep ourselves and our children and our new believers safe from society. Well, actually, if you look around the room, you see that there are lots of air vents. Well, what the air vents are pouring into the church is the poisoned air of the culture. We breathe, even if we think we're safe in the church, the same air that the culture breathes. Because, in fact, it's impossible to separate ourselves from the society. You simply can't. Actually, we have to live in it and work in it. It's not possible to separate ourselves entirely. We'd have to become monks and go and live in the desert on a pillar, or shut ourselves up in a cave if we really wanted to do a good job of creating a fortress or a haven for ourselves. And that wouldn't resolve the problem anyway, because we'd still have to deal with the problem of our own sinful nature and the devil. We might have held the world at bay, but the other two-thirds of the problem we all struggle with would be ever present. Actually, probably very much more present. If you read the accounts of the monks who did that, they found that their imaginations kind of ran wild and took over where the world might have not been quite so obvious. But this is the second thing I want to talk about, captivity by the culture. Some of you may have read an advance sort of press release of one of the opinion polls that Gallup has just been working on. It's not actually going to be published in its detail until early next year. But his findings are really striking, and they bear out what I want to speak about here. We know that maybe 40% of the population or even more go to church. 40% maybe or more can claim to be evangelical Christians who have a born-again relationship with Jesus Christ. But Gallup, in this poll, has sought to ask some very deep questions about people's actual Christian commitment, measured by what they really believe, measured by the basis on which they live their lives, measured by the priorities in their lives, measured by their actual lifestyle, measured by the quality, the integrity of their behavior, by whether there is prayer or not as an ongoing part of their life. All kinds of very basic questions which ought to tell us immediately whether somebody's a Christian or not. Not that any of us are ever perfect in any of these areas, but what he's trying to measure is commitment. And his conclusion is this, and it's very striking. His conclusion is that less than 10%, less than 1 in 10 of the American population is actually a committed Christian. That the vast majority of the people who come to our churches have no idea what being a committed Christian really is. It makes absolutely no difference to their lives. That's his conclusion. That less than 1 in 10 of the population can be considered to be a committed Christian in any real sense of the word, in terms of it actually having some effect, some genuine effect on their lives. Now, what are some of the problems here? What are some of the problems? And I want to suggest three areas under this second heading of captivity by the culture where we have some problems, and the point of all this, of course, is to help us to see what makes communication with the unbeliever difficult. The first is what I want to call a separation between truth and faith. A separation between truth and faith. There is absolutely no doubt that the vast majority of unbelievers have absolutely no idea at all that we believe that Christianity is actually true. I remember when I was converted, my parents thought it was just a stage I was going through. They said, "You're having a religious phase," and many people do at some point in their life, and that's very nice if it makes you feel good right now. But this was my religious phase. They had no notion whatsoever that I had come to believe something totally different about the nature of reality. That I was convinced that Christianity is the truth about the world in which we live. If you have seen Woody Allen's film, Crimes and Misdemeanors, marvelous film, which let me recommend to you. If you've seen his film, Crimes and Misdemeanors, there is a conversation in that where a Jew is talking with a skeptic about what he believes. And he says this at one point in the discussion, because he's asked a difficult question, and he says this: "If I have to choose between truth and God, I choose God every time." Now that's Woody Allen's view of where Christians are. That we really don't believe any truth, but we don't even think that we believe truth, that we just have this faith, this personal faith. Remember how I talked about that being one of the characteristics of the culture? That faith, what you believe, is a purely personal thing. You can believe what you like. Well, I think it's not just how non-Christians perceive us, but this problem is very deep in the church itself. I remember the first time I mentioned this in St. Louis, we had a meeting where we were having the opening, the formal opening of the Francis Schaeffer Institute at Covenant Seminary. And Edith Schaeffer had come down to speak for that. And in the process of introducing Edith, I said something, like Dick said earlier, about our conviction that Christianity is really the truth. And a member of the audience came up later, and she's a Christian, a member of a solid evangelical church, and she said to her husband, was standing there with her, and she says, "Isn't that exciting? I've never heard that idea before." Now that's something we could really start sharing with those non-Christians who we're getting to know. Christianity is actually the truth. It's really true. That was a completely new idea for her. Now, I think this is a very deep-seated problem. Just a few months ago, I was talking to the dean of a Christian college, the dean of faculty. And he said to me, "We have been trying in this college now for many years to bring about an integration of Christian faith with truth in every discipline in this college. Because if Christianity is true, well, it has something to say about every area, about the sciences, about maths, about English, about history, about psychology, sociology, medicine, everything. Because all truth in the end is God's truth, and all truth has to be subjected to His word. As Dick said, quoting 2 Corinthians 10, every thought has to be taken captive to Christ." But this dean of a Christian college said this to me, "We've found it extremely difficult. There has been a tremendous resistance from some of the members of the faculty, all Christians, to bring about this integration of faith with truth in the different disciplines at the college." He said, "In fact, I've even had some of the faculty accusing me of demanding a kind of Christian political correctness." You know, just like some of the secular universities where you have to conform to certain ideas. Dick may be talking about that at some point later. He certainly will if you ask him. And there's some tapes of his there. He's done a lot of thinking about it. But he was accused of demanding political correctness, making everybody toe a party line. But let me ask you just to think about that. Just the thought that to say that the Christian faith must be brought to bear on every discipline because Christianity is truth was regarded as an objectionable notion by Christian members of the faculty at that college. Well, let me give you another illustration. I have a niece who's been studying at a Christian college, and she's just transferring to a secular university. And she said to my wife and I one evening, "One of the reasons I'm transferring is because our history course has been taught by a very radical feminist." This is in an evangelical college. She said, "What she is teaching is absolutely indistinguishable from what I would get at any secular university where a radical feminist was teaching." And she said, "I just really object to being put in a situation where the only Christian thing about the class is that the teacher prays at the beginning of the class. And then the history we get has got absolutely nothing to do with any kind of Christian understanding of the world or of history at all." And what she said was this. She said, "Actually, what I'm really fed up with is it being demanded by my teacher that I become bitter about everything." Because that was the teacher's real program, to make every woman in the class bitter about being a woman. That's not Christian education of any kind. But that is not an isolated problem when I mention an example like that. I could immediately cite dozens of other examples like that, of this lack of integration of faith and truth. Perhaps one of the most amusing but saddest examples I've come across was some people we got to know out west of this total lack of integration. This one man we know, he's been a member and his family have been members for generations of an evangelical church which is committed to pacifism. And one can respect somebody's commitment to pacifism. But we actually rented this man's house while we were there in California. And in the mail every week, he would get Lyndon LaRouche's newspaper. And all sorts of papers supporting Oliver North and the Iran-Contra affair. Now, just try to put that together. Here this man is a really committed pacifist on the grounds of his Christian faith, so much so that he and his son had been conscientious objectors when it came to the war. But at the same time, he's supporting the really radical, maybe even violent views of somebody like Lyndon LaRouche, and supporting what happened in the Iran-Contra affair and Oliver North and so on. Now, there's a total failure at that point to bring Christian faith and what he thought about other areas of life together, even though at that point it was so obvious for somebody who was a pacifist that those positions must be totally untenable. And that is an extreme example, of course. One of the more common areas where we fail to do this is with regard to the reality of the brokenness of this world, living in the shadow of the fall, what Dick spoke about. If you think about the prosperity gospel, and you read what the Bible has to say about the brokenness of human existence, there's a total failure in that gospel to put faith and truth, faith and reality together. That's the first problem. As we think about this captivity by the culture, because in doing this, in separating faith and truth, we have fallen right into the trap of our society, which says you can believe anything you want to, but it isn't true. That's just your personal faith, your personal belief, which you have a right to have, but don't impose it on anybody else. Unless we are making truth claims, we are never going to communicate to anybody in this society. The second area here is the separation of faith and life. The separation of faith and life. Again, for our culture, you can believe whatever you like, just don't let it hang out in public. Just don't let it start affecting the way you live. You can have your own private belief, but it doesn't need to come into the marketplace of ideas, of actually the way people live. Now, again, this is the way the culture sees us, that there is no union among us between faith and life. I heard in St. Louis just a few weeks ago an ad, in fact it's run regularly now on the radio, from a company that advises businesses on how to be efficient businesses. And one of the things they say in this advert is, one of the things we will advise you to do to make your business successful is to go to church. That's amazing. That is so. If you want to have a successful business, go to church. You can make lots of business contacts there. When I gave this example, this illustration down in Florida last week in Orlando, somebody came up to me afterwards and said, I came across this. I went into this shop where there was a fish in the window. And I said to the owner of the shop, "You must be a Christian." And the owner said, "Why do you say that? No, I'm not." Said, "Because you have a fish in your window. And that's a Christian symbol. You know, why Christians communicate to each other that we're Christians by having a fish here and there." You know, and of course it goes back to the early church. And the guy said, "Oh, that's interesting. I wondered what it meant, but I just put it there because it's good for business." He's serious. "I put it there because it's good for business, just like going to church is good for business." Now that's an amazing thing to say to an Englishman, because you can't imagine a British company sending its executives or its workers to church because it would help their business. That would be the very last thing that anybody would think of. But that tells us, too, something about the separation between faith and life. Because if we were really clearly teaching in our churches what a Christian life should be like, there's no way that non-Christian businesses would be sending people there to simply further their business. They would feel so uncomfortable if we spoke about Christian work ethics and Christian business ethics that they simply wouldn't stay. But we don't. I've been in the States now 2.5 years, and I haven't heard a single sermon yet on work, on business ethics. Even though there is a vast amount of teaching in the Bible on work and business ethics, and even though almost every member of our congregation is working, and many of them are involved in business, there really is a separation of faith and life. Let me give you some illustrations of this. A Jewish Christian came to speak to me just a couple of months ago in St. Louis. And she said, I've come to talk to you about something I'm struggling with. I've been a Christian now for 10 or 12 years. I can't remember how exactly long she said it was. And she said, I come from a very secular Jewish family. My family have been secular for 2 or 3 generations. They're still Jewish culturally, of course, but they no longer believe Judaism. And that's been so for several generations. But, she said, I have a real problem. I've been a Christian now for 10, 12 years. And she said, I see such a radical failure of Christians in our churches to be righteous in their business practice, to be righteous in their places of work. And I see such a radical failure among us to have any kind of commitment to public service, to really seeking to be servants to the society. And she said, the context in which I grew up, which was a completely unbelieving one, was one of righteousness in business, righteousness in the workplace, was one of commitment to public service. My family have been that way for generations. She says, how is it that unbelieving Jews can have so much more integrity than Christians who know the truth, who have found Christ, who are living by the power of the Holy Spirit? And she said, it's making me question whether I really should be a Christian at all, because it is so distressing and is such a stumbling block for my family, to members of my family. The Jewish members of my family are constantly telling me examples of bad, of unrighteous business practice among Christians that they have to work with. Now, I've experienced that myself. I have a non-Christian friend I get together with regularly in St. Louis. And one day he said this to me just straight. He said, Jerem, why is it that so many Christian institutions and so many Christians in business are so lacking in business integrity? He just came straight out and said it. And he's a real cynic. Coming back to where I started this evening. And he is a man who, as a real cynic, is known all over St. Louis for the integrity of his business practice. And he says to me, why? Why are you Christians so lacking in business integrity? Or to give another illustration, a friend of mine in California, in fact, my eldest son, is out in California this summer working with him. He's a house builder. He builds very fine houses. He does excellent work. But for years, he was a member of the largest evangelical church in the town in which he lives. A town of 12,000 people with a large church of 2,000. Solidly evangelical. And he said to me one day, he said, Jerem, I finally had to leave that church, and you know why? Because it was bad for my business to be a member of it. Because the men in that church are known in this whole community for shoddy, for unfair, for sharp business practice. Now, that sadly is far too much of a reality. Just a radical separation of faith and life. These two kept apart. And thirdly, as we think about this captivity by the culture, the third problem is the separation of faith and spirituality. Faith and truth, faith and life, faith and spirituality. What do I mean? If you look at the televangelist scandal, I would suggest to you that while the problems of sexual infidelity, while the financial problems are both really serious, that underlying them was another problem. And that was this problem: the separation of faith and spirituality. There was lots of talk about spirituality. But when you look at those two empires, and that's what you have to call them, they were examples, sadly, of men building their own kingdoms. Not people living by faith. Not people living by prayer. Not people trusting the living God. But people building their own kingdoms. That may seem a very harsh thing to say, but I think it is one of the very serious problems we face in the church. That the unbeliever looks at us and he sees a lack of reality. Non-Christians were criticizing those men long before the church got round to saying anything about it. In fact, it was the secular culture which brought them down. It wasn't the church. But judgment has to begin with the household of God, says God's word. But because we didn't do that, the society had to do it. It became such an offense. Now I want to suggest that that is a problem that exists very widely in the church. That in many of our churches we carry on much of the time as if God did not exist, as if we did not believe in the Holy Spirit, as if we had totally forgotten the power of prayer. Schaefer wrote into the consensus for LaBrie's operation the following words. He said, we choose to draw a distinction. We want to make a distinction between men and women, even Christian men and women, building the kingdom of God, and men and women praying that God will build his kingdom and be pleased to use their efforts as he does so. There's a profound difference in mentality there. Do we think that we, by our strength, by our wisdom, by our gifts, by our ability, are building the kingdom of God? If we do, we'll end up building our own kingdoms. Or do we pray that God will build his kingdom? Do we stand before him in humility, saying, you are the Lord. I'm not worthy so much as to lift my eyes up to heaven. Lord, you build your kingdom. You take my weak efforts, my inadequate gifts, my inadequate zeal, my righteousness, which is so far short of your glory. And Lord, please build your kingdom by your power, by the work of your Spirit. But we have been so seduced by all kinds of programs, by all kinds of business methods, by things from every area of our society, by every kind of latest psychological fad, by every sociological technique, we think that we will build the Church of Christ. All we've got to do is use these methods and it will happen. All we've got to do is run everything decently in an order like a good business meeting and the church will grow. Well, it won't. Now, of course, we've got to do things right. We can learn from psychology. We can learn from sociology. We can learn from sensible and righteous business practice about how to do the work of the church. But at the very heart of it, if there is a division between faith and spirituality, we have nothing to offer to the world, absolutely nothing, because we are just a very poor imitation of what the world itself is, borrowing its methods, borrowing its techniques, and seeking to do the work of the kingdom with them. And people see right through that. They see right through it. If we are going to communicate, we need to have a vital spirituality, a genuine commitment to prayer, a conviction that God is the one who can build his kingdom, not us. Now, I want to suggest to you, and I want to stop here, I've gone on much too long, I want to suggest to you that the most difficult problem we face, the real problem we face, the reason why we find it difficult to communicate to non-Christians is not really the barriers raised by the culture. It is our own problems, our own barriers. It is the walls we have built. Now, let me open this up to discussion. Please, if you want to ask a question, if you want to make a comment, go to one of the microphones. If you want to ask me to clarify something I've said, if you want to disagree with something I've said, if you want to push me a little bit or a lot, I don't mind at all. You know, whatever, head off to a microphone, ask a question, and we'll get going. I know it's difficult on the first evening. You have to get used to the fact that this is the way that that we function in these things. So just head for your microphone, and if there's a couple of you want to go to them, just get in line, and I'll try to deal with you in the order you get there. Yeah, it's on.
The question is whether or not I can reach it. I am following you all the way to the final point you made, and I've just been mulling about this for the last several days. It's hard for me to discern between doing things within my own strength and with my own wisdom and my own perspective on how things operate, and being absolutely passive. I don't understand how one discerns, how one figures out that one is really looking to God to build his kingdom and bringing to bear one's whole mind and spirit and energy to do what there is to be done. I don't know how you sort this out and have integrity.
That's a great question. Let me suggest the beginning of an answer. You'll be aware, as Dick mentioned earlier, that there is a very strong tradition within evangelicalism which teaches that spirituality is fundamentally passive, that the real goal of the Christian life is to kill oneself, to be broken completely, to be totally yielded to God so that there's none of me left. And the image which is used over and over again is the image of a glass tube, that you have got to become like a glass tube in which you are no longer there. Your personality has disappeared. There is simply Christ to be seen. Or Watchman Nee, who's one of the foremost exponents of this kind of teaching, uses the image of the box of alabaster ointment, that you are the box of precious ointment which has to be broken before Jesus can do anything. You've got to die so that he can live. Now, I want to suggest that, as Dick did earlier, that whole approach to spirituality is fundamentally flawed. That it really isn't biblical. The heart of the Christian life in the New Testament is not replacement by the Holy Spirit or replacement by Christ. It is restoration. by the power of the Holy Spirit until I become the kind of person that God originally created me to be. That's how Paul defines Christian growth in Ephesians 4:24, and in Colossians 3:9-10, that we will be restored to the image of God, to the likeness of God in true righteousness and holiness. So as we think about true spirituality, and what I've been talking about dependence, about prayer, about really seeking that God will build his kingdom, not me, not thinking I can do it, I'm not talking for one moment about banishing myself, about saying, well, my mind is worthless, my choices are worthless, my emotions are worthless, my imagination is worthless. God wants me to work with every effort that I have, with every aspect of my humanity in his service. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, says the apostle, because God is at work in you, both to will and to do of his good pleasure. And you can think of all the language of the New Testament that you've got to get in. The Christian life is likened to a battle. You have got to fight. You have not yet resisted against sin to the point of shedding your blood, says the apostle. Put those sinful desires to death. That's what you've got to put to death, not yourself, sin. Clothe yourselves with righteousness, with kindness, with gentleness, with humility, with love, with patience. Keep working away. Renew your mind. I mean, you can think of all these very active verbs over and over again. You've got to plant your field. You've got to fight like a soldier. You've got to wrestle. You know, I pummel my body and subdue it, says the apostle Paul. I wrestle. I'm running a race, you know, and I'm just about to finish it, he says. So the Christian life is not passive. It is active. We must be committed to an active obedience, to having our minds renewed in subjection to the Word of God so that I start thinking God's thoughts after him, to having our emotions renewed so that what I feel in my heart is pleasing to God, that instead of hatred and resentment and bitterness and anger and malice and envy, I start feeling kindness and gentleness and love and joy and peace. And to have my imagination sanctified. I'm going to talk about whether we need poets or not in one of my seminars. And I think God is very interested in our imaginations. He has the most wonderful imagination himself. And our wills, really committing our wills to daily, practical, momentary obedience. What I'm speaking about when I speak about not building our own kingdoms is something very different. And that is that we really know that even when we devote ourselves with the completeness of our ability to the Lord's work, with our mind, our will, our emotions, our imagination, that like the parable says, we are unworthy servants. Compared with the righteousness of God, I still fall so far short. Compared with the truth of God, my ideas are just beginning to be conformed to his. And that's true with every aspect of my life. I look at everything I do and I have to say, there's an image I like to use, is I'm like one of those apples that you bite into and you can't find any good bits in it. It looks all right on the outside, and everywhere through those little brown spots. You've all tried to eat an apple like that and there's nothing there to eat. Well, that's the way all of us are. That's what it means to be a sinner. Sin dwells not just in a few actions or words that I say, it dwells within me. You know, I am a sinner. That is the reality of who I am, and I'm going to be that way until the day I die. There are such flaws in us. And when I look at even the very best things in my life that I've done, I see so many weaknesses and so many poor motivations. And I become overwhelmed when I look at it, and I think, well, if only I could be the kind of husband that God wants me to be, the kind of father that he wants me to be, the kind of seminary teacher, the sort of pastor. But I simply am not. Compared with him, I'm down here somewhere. I mean, such a long way down. Now, it is that sense of knowing who I really am before God and who He is, His glory, His righteousness, His love, that makes me get on my knees and say, Lord, unless You build the house, I labor totally in vain. You are the one who've got to build it. I can't build it. And Wim is going to use in one of his lectures, I'll steal his thunder here, the most beautiful image. He says, if we think about the things we do, it's like the 5 loaves and the fishes that that little boy offered to Jesus. And he made enough to feed 5,000 people. And there was still some left over. Well, God does that with what we do. He is able to multiply our efforts. You know, we sow, somebody else waters, but God's the one who gives the increase. If I ask, can I save anybody by my wisdom, by my reasoning, by the quality of my example, by my love for them, of course I can't. God calls me to speak the truth to them, to live before them in a righteous way. But Paul says in Corinthians that it takes the same kind of work that it took God to create the universe to save anybody. The same God who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shone into our hearts with the light of the knowledge of the gospel of Jesus Christ.